to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear an interesting talk by Richard Heinberg. It's about the global economy, and global energy use, and global warming, and how a change has gotta come in all three, and in some other things besides. I hope you'll stay tuned. On this show, we've heard a lot of sound bites by Richard Heinberg, and even a few complete paragraphs. Today and next week, at last, we'll hear him at some length. Heinberg seems to be the driving force behind the Post-Carbon Institute. For some years, he's been talking about peak oil, ecology and the environment, the global economic system, population growth, and related matters. Put them all together, and what do you have? Not just a mess, but an unsustainable mess. To put the global problem as simply as possible, the whole system that's in place depends on constant growth. And the whole system is no longer working, because a finite ecosystem cannot support constant growth forever. As Heinberg sees it, we have reached the limit. It's here. And so the system is breaking down. Energy use cannot keep growing as it has been, or growing at all. Debt cannot keep growing much higher. The rate we're cutting down our forests and killing the fish and polluting the air cannot keep growing. And as Heinberg sees it, the population cannot keep growing the way it has been. So the system is now beginning to collapse. Even theoretically, the system cannot possibly keep growing in the same direction it has been since, let's say, 1800. A sustainable future will have to have less burning of oil, less travel, less pollution, local farms, and fewer consumer goods. The good news is that, with all this, we could well end up much happier than we are, have a better, if lower-tech, life. Heinberg does a fine job at making connections between events in our world, at showing how one problem is related to another. He gave this talk in Chicago on November 22, 2012. It's titled, Life After Growth: Why the Economy is Shrinking and What to Do About It.
So where are we now? Year 2012. We're coming up to the period where the Limits to Growth study forecast a peak in decline in world industrial output. Now, I think this is actually exactly what we're seeing right now and have been since 2008 or before. But the signals are being ignored or misinterpreted. I want to unpack those signals with you in the next few minutes using these three factors. Now, not all of them were discussed in the Limits to Growth scenario study. Energy and environment were, but not specifically climate change and not debt. There was a deliberate decision on the part of the authors of the study to exclude the financial system from consideration in the other more environmental factors. But as we've found during these past 4 years, you can't really do that. You can't exclude the financial system from our analysis. So we'll put that back in. First of all, energy. As I suggested earlier, energy is the driver of everything. Why? Because it takes energy to do literally everything we do. And if you have lots of cheap energy, you can do things that you couldn't do before. And that's basically what's happened to us over the past couple of hundred years. We've always used energy, but it previously had been in the forms of, you know, food and firewood. We'd exerted energy into our environment by way of muscle power, either human or animal. But with fossil fuels, we gained access to energy sources that had been produced over the course of tens of millions of years through processes into which we had to invest no effort whatsoever. Highly concentrated, portable energy sources. Think about it this way. Maybe you've had the experience of running out of gas in your car and having to push your car 10 feet off to the side of the road. It's a fair amount of work, right? Now imagine pushing your car for, let's say, 25 or 30 miles. How much work is that? Well, if you do the math, of course, it depends on what the extent to which you're using your arm or leg muscles and how big a person you are, how big the car is, and so on. But it's a pretty fair estimate to say it's a couple of months of hard labor pushing your car 30 miles. Well, we get that done for us with a single gallon of gas for which we're paying less than $4 and complaining. You can't get labor that cheap anywhere on the planet. And, of course, that's why we have mechanized every process of production and transport that we possibly could over the past few decades. And that's given us enormous economic growth. But oil, which is economically the most crucial of the fossil fuels because it represents virtually all of transport energy, oil, like the other fossil fuels, is non-renewable and depleting. We've learned that in this country. You know, this is where the oil industry started. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, we were the world's foremost oil exporting nation. More than half the world's oil was coming from oil fields in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, California, places like that. But discoveries of oil reached a maximum around 1930 and have generally been declining since then. Actual production of oil, or extraction of oil, as I prefer to say, in the U.S., has been declining since 1970. We've had some good luck the last few years as a result of applying extraordinary technologies to low-quality reservoirs in places like North Dakota. But we still have a long way to go to catch up to where we were in 1970, and we certainly won't get there. We won't see a new peak in U.S. oil production. Now, this same peaking and decline phenomenon that we've seen here in the U.S. is being mimicked in country after country around the world. Countries that used to be oil exporting nations are now oil importing nations: Indonesia, Great Britain. World oil discoveries have been declining since about 1964. So it's not just a couple of years of bad luck. This is a long-established trend. Actual world crude oil production has been flat since 2005. And that's in the context of very high oil prices. So there's every incentive for oil producers to bring as much to market as they possibly can. But again, actual production has stalled out. Why so? Well, it's because the oil industry has changed so much, so fast. This is what it looked like back in the 1930s. This is what it looks like today, when a single exploratory oil well in ultra-deep water can cost $500 million to drill and still come up dry. The industry needs high oil prices in order to justify applying these extraordinary new technologies to the kinds of reservoirs that are left, which are certainly not the best. We've gone about extracting fossil fuels using the low-hanging fruit principle. So we got the cheap, easy stuff early in the game. What's left is basically the dregs. So the industry needs high oil prices, and that's what we've been seeing. But high oil prices have an economic impact. And we've been seeing that since the 1970s, since the first oil crisis of 1973. Every time we've had an oil price spike, we've had a recession immediately follow. Now, here's our situation today in a nutshell. The industry needs prices in the range of $100 a barrel, and the global price of oil is still over $100 a barrel right now. The industry needs prices in that range in order to justify going out and fracking or deep water drilling. But meanwhile, we know from recent history when prices are that high and they stay there for very long, it causes the economy either to stall out or to go into a tailspin. So we've reached a situation where global oil prices and supplies by themselves are undermining world economic growth and the prospects for world economic growth. Of course, that's not all that's happening. We've heard about this debt crisis over the past few years. What's all that about? Well, let me tell you the story of how we got hooked on debt. It starts in the early 20th century, once again with fossil fuels. One of the things that fossil fuels enabled us to do was to produce stuff in larger quantities and faster than we ever had before with powered assembly lines. So we could make all kinds of consumer products in vast array and abundance, like automobiles. Here's an ad for a Studebaker in 1910. The problem in the early 20th century was a problem of overproduction. Okay? We could flood markets with consumer products that people weren't able to buy. They didn't necessarily want to buy them, and they didn't have the money to buy them. So we solved those problems. We helped them want to buy them with advertising. And over the course of the 20th century, advertising became a ginormous industry. But we also helped people go into debt to buy things with consumer credit. This was a phenomenon of the mid-20th century and the late 20th century. It started in the automobile industry, but it spread throughout society. So this was a deliberate effort to increase economic activity, to make the economy grow. Consume now, pay later. And we're talking here mostly about household debt. Government debt is another problem, which we'll get to in just a moment. Now, in this story of how we got hooked on debt, there's a turning point in the 1980s that's really important to understand. Follow me for just a moment. This is a little bit of technical information, but not too much. This is a paper that was just published a few months ago by an esteemed economist, Robert Gordon. It's being discussed widely among economists these days. It has the startling title, "Is U.S. Economic Growth Over?" Briefly, what Gordon is saying is that the data clearly show that there have been three phases of economic growth since the beginning of the industrial period. The first phase was characterized by railroads, steam power, and coal. The second phase was characterized by oil, electrification, and all of the transportation technology and gadgets that went with oil and electrification, like cars and planes and refrigerators and all the rest. The third phase of the industrial period started in the 1980s and was characterized by computers, the internet, cell phones, all the electronic eye stuff that is part of our lives today. Now, Gordon shows that it was the second of those phases that brought with it by far the lion's share of economic growth. That second phase of oil, electrification, cars, airplanes, air conditioners, vacuum cleaners. Once people had, in the industrialized world, had already bought their first car and et cetera, economic growth started to stall out as a result of the law of diminishing returns. And then when the third phase of the industrial period kicked in with the internet and cell phones and all the rest, that did produce another little burst of economic growth, but it was far, far smaller than what had preceded it. So what this tells us is that, yes, technological change does bring economic growth, but not necessarily of an enormous scale. Gordon raises the question in his paper, what if that second phase, that big mountain of growth that came with cars and oil and electrification, what if that was a one-off and it's already past its prime? So now maybe U.S. economic growth is over. Something else happened in the 1980s, though. In addition to the law of diminishing returns kicking in with regard to that second phase of the industrial period, that other thing that happened in the 1980s was, of course, globalization. As a result of container ships and computerized monitoring of inventories and so on, it became possible to outsource labor across the planet. So American factory workers suddenly were competing with factory workers in China and elsewhere. Okay, so this had the effect of depressing wages for hourly factory workers in the U.S. And in fact, the average hourly wage for an American worker today is about the same as it was in 1973 if adjusted for inflation. So here's a problem. If by this time, and as was the case, the economy depended on consumer spending for its vitality and growth, but consumers didn't have any more money in their pockets from one year to the next, how do you make that happen? How do you make that growth occur? Well, the answer was more debt. So starting in the 1980s, we have innovation in the financial industry in the form of credit cards and ultimately in no-doc loans and subprime mortgages, easier car loans and all the rest, more student loans. So the average household is taking on more and more debt in order to spend more and more money to make the economy grow. Since 1980, debt has grown at about 3 times the rate of GDP. In the U.S. and in many other countries around the world, European countries, Australia, New Zealand, all in the same boat. So that's kept the economy growing, but there's a price to pay. You can't keep increasing debt forever. There are limits, natural limits to debt. Think about it. If you take on so much debt that you can't afford to make monthly payments and the bank doesn't want to loan you any more money, you've reached the end of the road, right? Well, that's essentially what happened in 2008. This is a picture of our total national debt situation. As you can see, most of the growth in debt up until 2008 was in the corporate and household sectors, not government debt. It wasn't growing any faster. In fact, it was growing slower than these other sectors. But then in 2008, the picture changes completely. Suddenly, debt starts disappearing from the rest of the economy. How can debt just disappear? Through default? Through suddenly loans not being worth as much as they were? You know, if you take out a home equity line of credit based on your house being worth $500,000 and suddenly it's only worth $300,000, that loan is now a toxic asset for the bank. That has to be, in many cases, has to be written off. And in that process of writing off the loan, wealth disappears from the economy. And this is what happened to the tune of trillions of dollars starting in 2008. So the government and the Federal Reserve step in as the borrowers and lenders and spenders of last resort in order to keep the economy from imploding. And we're still there. The federal government is deficit spending at a rate of $100 billion a month right now. Now, of course, we look at that and we say, well, that can't go on. The government can't afford to do that forever. We can't keep increasing government debt at this rate. However, on the other hand, if we stop, go cold turkey, the inevitable result will be the economy will relapse and go back into a tailspin. So we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place here. We've reached the end of the road in terms of a certain kind of economy. I think our former president said it best back in 2008. If we don't loosen up some money, this sucker could go down. And by using the technical term, this sucker, he was actually referring to the U.S. financial system and by extension, the global financial system. Well, we did loosen up some money, trillions of dollars from the Federal Reserve, from the U.S. Treasury and other nations around the world, and we're still doing it. And all it's doing is buying us time. Okay, this is the third factor that we're looking at, climate change. I'm not going to go into great detail here because I trust that you all know the basics here. We're engaged in history's biggest chemistry experiment. We're changing the composition of Earth's atmosphere and the Earth's oceans. And we're doing it on a fairly rapid basis. And as a result, temperatures are going up. We're already at least on track for 2 degrees of warming with just the amount of CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere. And we're seeing consequences from that. We had a massive drought, of course, in the United States this year, as we all know. Again, I'm sure we all know the North Polar ice cap is disappearing before our very eyes. Will probably be gone in summer months by 2020, perhaps even sooner. And as we just saw over the last few days, weird weather is taking an economic as well as a human toll. So we could be on track actually for much more warming than I think most of us are anticipating as a result of self-reinforcing feedbacks. Now that sounds kind of technical, but what it simply means is as, for example, as the North Polar ice cap melts, that means there's more open water during the summer. And that dark water absorbs a lot more solar radiation than the white ice does. So that means the water warms even faster and makes the ice melt even faster, which causes even more black water to open up, which you get the picture. It's a self-reinforcing feedback. There are two or three of those that are happening. One has to do with methane. Again, in the Arctic, There's a lot of methane trapped in tundra and also in methane hydrates, crystals of water and methane. Methane is the main ingredient of natural gas, in case you're wondering. Methane is also an intensive greenhouse gas. Over a short period of, let's say, a decade, methane is about 100 times as powerful a greenhouse gas, a heat trapper, as CO2. So as methane is released from the Arctic tundra or from beneath the seabeds and goes up into the atmosphere, it causes the Earth's climate to warm even faster, which releases more methane, which causes, and so on. So again, we could be looking perhaps at as much as 6 degrees warming by the end of the century. This has, again, as we've just seen with Hurricane Sandy, it has economic as well as environmental and human consequences. So if we extrapolate out just a few years, the economic costs of climate change and other environmental crises, these will equal or surpass the amount of economic growth we're seeing. And if we get to the point where most economic growth is coming about as a result of people spending money just to recover from environmental disasters, well, what kind of growth is that anyway? It's more ilth than wealth. Okay, so here we are. For the past few decades, we've been on this accelerating train of economic growth. And it feels exhilarating. It's a good thing, after all, because with economic growth, we have more jobs. We have more tax revenues for governments so that governments can provide more services. We have more returns for investors. Everybody has good reasons for wanting more and more economic growth. The train is never going quite fast enough for us. We want it to go just a little bit faster next year and a little bit faster the year after that. But the reality is we live on a finite planet. Can you have perpetual economic growth on a finite planet? Well, actually, no. Not if that growth entails increased consumption of resources. And so far it has. I mean, what do you spend money on if not stuff? Think of it this way. Imagine a baby hamster. A baby hamster is a very tiny thing. Doesn't weigh very much, but it grows very rapidly. A baby hamster doubles its body weight every week for the first few weeks of its life. Now, let's do a little thought experiment. If we had a magic hamster that could continue doubling its body weight every week for one whole year, 52 doublings, how big a hamster would we have? Would it be a 50-pound hamster? Would it be a 500-pound hamster? The New Economics Foundation in London has done the math for us. It turns out it would be a 9-billion-ton hamster. Now, that just illustrates the absurdity of continuous compounded economic growth, which is what we all assume is going to happen in the future. Well, continuous compounded growth implies a doubling time. When we think of economic growth, we usually think of, well, you know, 3, 4, 5% per year. It sounds so innocent, right? Well, what's the doubling time? With 1% growth, the doubling time is 70 years. With 2%, about 35 years. And you can do the math yourself. China's been growing at a rate of about 10% per year. The doubling time is 7 years. So think about that. Every 7 years, the magnitude of China's economy doubles. The amount of coal that's being used, steel, cement, all the rest, pretty much doubles. Can China's economy double even one more time? I think it's entirely reasonable to hold doubts about that. And in fact, China's economy is slowing down, as are the economies of just about every other country on the planet. We have impacts baked in to the cake at this point. Climate impacts, environmental impacts of all kinds, economic impacts. So what we need to be doing is making other plans. Rather than promising more and more economic growth, as both political candidates have been doing over the past few months, we should be thinking about what kind of economy will serve us in the future if it's a non-growing economy.
Chain don't come.
A little Tina Turner there, and before that, we heard Richard Hineberg on Why Constant Growth Has Got to Stop, and Will, and Good Riddance to It. We'll hear the remainder of this talk next week. Many thanks to Alex Smith, who broadcast the talk on Radio EcoShock and made the recording available. www.ecoshock.org. You'll find more on Hineberg's work at richardhineberg.com. That's spelled H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, richardhineberg.com. And if you've got your web browser going, why not mosey over to our own site, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. There you'll find a nearly complete archive of all our broadcasts, good links, pretty pictures, and whatnot. Once again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. For New World Notes, this is Kenneth Doust advising, have a safe and sane Groundhog Day. Eat more kale, preferably local kale. Try to speak the truth. Illigitimae non carborundum, and ciao.